And we're sick and tired of three dimensions and fake physics and physics if the world had any different dimensions. This is the real world. Doesn't mean it's the right theory, but at least there's a chance. The other one didn't have a chance to start with. So this means four dimension and Lorentz. As far as we know, the world is four-dimensional Lorentzian. It's a great colleague of mine that was in Pittsburgh when I was in Pittsburgh that had on his wall a referee report for a paper he sent to some journal. The referee report said, this is not very interesting because it's in the Lorentzian context, and the interesting one is the Euclidean context. So this is a good example of how theoretical physics can become completely silly at some point. And just get lost in its own problems, forgetting that there is a real world out there. So let's start from general relativity in the variables and with the action that I wrote down the other time. So the action is going to be function of a tetrad, tetrad, not a triad, and a spin connection. And is going to be the integral of E wedge F star plus this other term, which I introduced, E wedge F, where the star means that there is a Minkowski index here, Minkowski index here, two Minkowski indices here. I'm contracting it with an epsilon. And here, no star means there's an Minkowski index here, Minkowski index here, and contracting with the two indices here without any epsilon, right? Which is Minkowski matrix. And so this describes the classical gravity with all its phenomenology as we know it. And the coefficient here, I'm going to put it equal to 1, which means that 8 pi g is equal to 1 in this unit. I'm going to take h bar equal to 1 in this unit. I'm careful because later on, I'll bring back physical units, so I'll have to bring back this quantity. And if you want, also C is equal to 1. So Newton constant, 8 h bar the Newton constant, sorry, 8 pi the Newton constant, Planck constant divided by 2 pi, and the speed of light are equal to 1 in these units. All right, so it's convenient to think about that in the following manner, just convenience. E wedge E, two Minkowski indices, star, means epsilon attached to these two Minkowski indices, plus one of the gamma E wedge E, all that wedge F. And it's convenient to call this square parenthesis here B. So let me call this B. This is going to be B. So B is this thing here, E wedge E star plus 1 of the gamma E wedge E. Okay? So it's a function of E. Now, what is it? It's a two-form with the two antisymmetric indices. So if you want, it's a two-form with values in the Lie algebra of SL2C, to be precise. So in the adjoint in the adjoint representation of SL2C. Okay? That clear? So it's with indices B mu nu, function of x with ij, antisymmetric downstairs and upstairs. Pretty obvious. This is mu, symmetrize, and you have two possible antisymmetric combinations. Take a linear combination with this coefficient. So the fields here in play, let's just be careful, are E, omega, and then B is just a certain function of E, where this is a one form with values in Minkowski space. So in the fundamental representation of SL3Y, or in the vector representation of SL2C, this is a SL2C connection. So this is a one form in R3Y. This is a SL2C connection, so it lives in SL2C, okay, which is the same as the algebra of Lorentz group. And this is a two-form, also in SL2C. Okay, and this is just a function of that. So that's the theory we're working on, and of course, it is invariant under local SL to C transformations. Okay. And of course, under diffeomorphism. And it's just generativity. Good. So, we're going to look at this theory. We're going to do two things, right? Look at the boundary, construct the Hilbert space, the operators, and then the transition amplitudes. So, if all go right today, I'll do the boundary and the Hilbert space and operators that describe quantum geometry, the possibly true real quantum geometry of three-dimensional space. And then next week, we'll transition amplitudes and see what we can do with them. So let's stay in the classical theory for the moment and let's see what happened at the boundary, because it's convenient to do something, which is always done, and it simplifies the theory a lot. So what is on the boundary of this theory? So imagine that this is space-time. So this is a M. It's a four-dimensional manifold, okay? And it has a boundary. We don't need it, the boundary, to have two disconnected components. In fact, later on, we'll just drop this. But it's convenient to think that there is some past time and some future time, and we're evolving from past to future, simplest way. And that's it, okay? You may think that this is it. There are just past and future, right? In Minkowski space, you can write surface like that and a surface like that. This is a past and future. We evolve from that to that. Or you may think that it's a compact three-dimensional space with just two disconnected pieces of path, right? The universe, imagine the universe is a three-sphere, starts from a three-sphere, so it's a three-dimensional surface. You evolve it for a while, and you get another three-sphere. So say this is one connected component of the boundary. Sigma is 3D. That's my boundary. Now, as soon as I have a boundary, because this is not exactly a gauge theory, because there's this tetrad field, there's this E, not just a connection, something peculiar happens to the gauge invariance, to the local gauge invariance because of the boundary, which is pretty obvious physically and is always used when one thinks about theory generativity in the canonical formulas. So let me do it carefully. And let me sort of do it. Halfway using coordinates, halfway not using coordinates, trying to be as clear as possible. Because there is a boundary, there is a normal to the boundary. Okay, the normal is the one that doesn't. I mean, the one does not require coordinates. So let's say x mu are my coordinates in M, and let me put three-dimensional coordinate sigma a here. In sigma, so a is 1, 2, 3 as usual, mu is 0, 1, 2, 3, and a is just 1, 2, 3. So then sigma is what? Is an embedding here, there. So it's defined by the map from those to those. So it's defined by four functions of three variables, of course. And if you take the derivatives of this four function of these variables, you get things which are the derivative x mu with respect to the sigma a. If you trace three of these things, anti-symmetrize, and put some epsilon, you get a vector with a downstairs index, right? So dx nu, dx rho, the sigma b, the sigma c, epsilon a, b, c, epsilon mu, nu, rho, sigma, this is some n sigma. So this is a covariant vector in the language of Riemannian geometry on the boundary, which is normal to the surface. The reason I'm doing carefully is just to, there's no metric here. This has nothing to do with metric. So it's well defined without the gravitational field, okay? However, if you have a tetrad, and we do have a tetrad, once you have n sigma, you can multiply it by E sigma I, sort of the inverse of the tetrad matrix, and you get an object Ni, which is a covariant vector in Minkowski space. It's covariant indices, right? So here you have because you have this object here. So geometrically, this is a soldering form, right? It attached tangent space to Minkowski space. So since you have a boundary, you have a special. In fact, to be precise, this is a three form, right? It's you want d sigma 1, d sigma 2, d sigma 3. So you have a special sort of local foliation of the tangent space, and because you have the soldering phase, it brings it to Minkowski space, which gives a Lorentz frame. So you have a Lorentz frame, okay? If you have a boundary, you have a Lorentz frame, okay? I'm not saying that's something. But now, if you have a Lorentz frame in all points, it means that you have a preferred direction in Minkowski space. So, in fact, you can use it and always sort of break your SL2C gauge invariance down to SO3. So in other words, we're going to do it over and over on the boundary, not on the bulk. On the bulk, you cannot do anything like that, because as soon as you're in the bulk, if you choose a foliation inside, you're physically doing something which you break the bounds of the theory. But the very fact that you have some observation on some boundary give you a preferred Lorentz frame on there. So on the boundary, it's really SO3 which matters, and we'll see how it matters. Now, something interesting happens to B because of that. B is I wanted you to pay attention on that because it's not a detail and it's going to be the key that opens the possibility of doing something reasonable in the theory. So B is a two form, but has two, is in the adjoint of SL2C. So has two Minkowski indices, like the Maxwell F mu nu, right? This is two Minkowski indices. Now, if you have Maxwell, the electromagnetic strength, and you have a preferred frame, what do you have? You have an electric field and a magnetic field immediately, right? Because once you have a frame, you can break the Maxwell tensor in two vectors, which are what? Are sort of the zero I, the time-space component, and the space-space component. There's no time-time because it's anti-symmetric. Okay? Let's do it a little bit covariantly. What is that Ni? This Ni, if I choose coordinates in which my surface is given by t equals 0, then obviously in these coordinates, this is just 1, 0, 0, 0. It's the thing that says which one is time. And if I choose internal coordinates in Minkowski space, where this is a diagonal, which in any point I can do, point by point, then this is 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay? And in fact, in general relativity, you know that you can always choose a gauge where g mu nu of x and t is given by a three-dimensional metric, GAB of x and t, and something collapse and shift, you can choose the way you want. And in particular, you can choose 0, 0, 0. So this is the time gauge in general relativity. Many calculations are done. So you can always go to those coordinates there in the time gauge, right? So in fact, in general relativity, you can always, if you want, break down the full four-dimensional Lorentz SL2C into SO3. That corresponds, to do that in general relativity, essentially you're choosing a foliation of space-time. Here, the boundary gives you in one point one piece of a foliation, so it allows you to do it. The boundary itself does it for you. I'm just giving you the various description of what is going on. What is going on is on the blackboard, it's not really. So we have this Ni, and we can multiply it with Bi, and we get what? This is 0, so we get the 0 component. We get the electric field, okay? So let me write it in a little bit more. Let me call this n times b, and I get something which I call k, which is electric field. Meaning, if you read this as a Maxwell field, it's this electric field component. What about its brother? It's just nb star, of course, which is L, just of the magnetic field. Again, if you are in coordinates where n has that form there, then this is nothing else that the zero, the space, the time-space component of B, and this is the space-space component. Okay? So far, so good. So instead of B, we can think of K and L. Like, instead of the Maxwell field, we can think of electric magnetic field. And in fact, it's immediate to see that this is one index, right? You can contract it again with n, and you get zero, because that was antisymmetric. And same for the other one. So these are in Minkowski space, but in fact, they only have the space component. So I can have only the 1, 2, 3 components. So in fact, I can call them, can forget the zero component and call them as two vectors, like we do in the magnetic and the electric field all the time. Okay, I can call them like that. Or if I could keep them as vectors in Minkowski space, but they're all orthogonal to n. Good. So why all these definitions? Because now something pretty happened. So we're on the boundary, and we have this n, and we have this b. These are just given. And look at what happens. B, it's not really a arbitrary matrix because it has that form there. Okay? So K, from the very definition, is N times E wedge E star plus 1 over gamma E wedge E. Okay? And obviously, NE is zero, right? On sigma, on the boundary. Because if I take my boundary, NE, from the definition, I'm going back to the object which is normal to the surface. The object which is normal to the surface, projected down to the surface, is zero. So NE is zero, N times, is multiply this E is zero. Here, no, because there's an epsilon. So if you want, on the boundary here, there's only space components. And while this one has time and a time and space component, because it's an epsilon. So this is zero. So the only thing that remains is N E wedge E star. All right, so what? Well, look at L. L is N times all this star. But all this star, if you star twice, you just get the same thing. So it's E wedge E plus 1 over gamma E wedge E star. Maybe you get a minus if you star twice. But this is zero, so forget the minus. And so you get 1 over gamma E wedge E star, okay, which is exactly the other one. So the electric and magnetic component of this object satisfy an equation which is L, K, is equal gamma L. I put vectors since this equation have no time component. Okay? This equation, it's going to have a crucial future. So we keep them there. One of the consequences of these equations, it's going to be enormously important in the transition amplitude, but let's now think just on the boundary of the geometry. One of the consequences is that if you know one, you know the other one. If you know the electric field, you know the magnetic field of this because of this particular form that this object has. So for the moment, let's just forget about K and just keep L on the boundary. Okay, that's one of my fields. And together with it, I have the connection on the boundary. But again, the connection on the boundary, I can always gauge fix it to keep n fixed. So I choose a gauge where n, where I only allow gauge transformation that don't turn my n. So I restrict myself from an SL2C connection to an SU2 connection. So omega, I can restrict it to an SO, if you want, the transformation that leaves n invariant, which are an SO3 subgroup of SO31. Since I'm looking at the algebra, it's the same as saying that SU2 is a subgroup of SL2C. Okay. Now, put this there, and let's start walking toward the quantum theory. And exactly as we did in three dimensions, what we want is to take these fields in the bulk, in the boundary, okay, discretize them, write proper Hilbert space and operators where they are represented in the boundary. In the boundary, we just need this and this, and then write the transition amplitude, or try to guess the transition amplitude, or find the transition amplitude, hope that something would give us decent transition amplitudes. Okay? So, first thing I have to do is to discretize. So, replace the continuous theory with a truncation of the theory, which, for given boundary condition, if it is fine enough, approximate arbitrarily well the dynamics. So what do I do? Well, I do exactly what I did in three dimensions. I'm just copying what I do in three dimensions. Three dimensions, I got a decent theory. This is enormously more complicated because this is a real field theory, an actual field theory, but let me do the same thing. So I'm going to introduce a discretization, a triangulation, delta. Now my manifold is four-dimensional. So instead of chopping it in tetrahedra, I have to chop it in the analogous thing in four dimensions, which is a four simplex. So what is a four simplex? Imagine you're in four dimensions, you have a tetrahedron, you get another point outside from the three-dimensional hyperplane where the tetrahedron lives, and you just connect it. Exactly the same way in which if you have a triangle, which is the thing that triangulates a two-dimensional thing, you get a tetrahedron which triangulating a three-dimensional thing, just put a point over it. So we chop our space-time manifold in four simplices, all attached to one another. And anytime there are two that are bound one another, of course, between the two, there is a tetrahedron now. Okay? The two four simplices, a tetrahedron. So between two of these, the tetrahedra. Or if you want, in the boundary of each four simplex, there's a certain number of tetrahedra, four if you count for a moment, because five if you count, because you, each time you take away a point, you have a tetrahedron, so five of them. The boundary of these is triangles. And the boundary of these is bonds. So the individual little lines, the bonds that build up the triangulation, and then the points. So this is the triangulation. But don't think too hard about that, because what we need, exactly like in three dimensions, everything is going to be much simpler. Is instead of thinking of the triangulation, think of the dual, the triangulation. So we will do what we did in three dimensions, and we construct the dual. And what is a dual? We just stick a point inside of each simplex, and we call it a vertex. So a point here in this thing which I'm building, it's what sits inside the four simplex, like before it sits inside the trade room. And it will have how what? It will have not four things that stick out, but five, obviously. One, two, three, four, five things that stick out, because there are five tetrahedra from which I can go out. So each tetrahedron here is between two force implices. So I represent it with one of these edges, and I call it edge. Okay. So, and an edge, now remember, in three dimensions, it had three faces around. Okay. So what is a face? A face is when it's something that in three dimensions I had a bone, and a face goes around the bone. In four dimensions, each time I have a triangle, I can go around the triangle. Why? Because think that the triangle is in the xy coordinates. Then, of course, I can go around it by going in the zt coordinates. So in four dimensions, two-dimensional things link one with another, right? In three dimensions, if you have a bone, you can go around, we can cut it with a face. In four dimensions, if you have a triangle, you can cut it with a face. Okay? So the xy triangle is cut with a zt face. So there's a face here that go around the triangles, go around each one of the triangle of this force simplex here, and I call it face. And of course, how many face bound one edge? Well, just think about three dimensions. In three dimensions, we had a triangle with three faces around. Here, there are four, obviously, because each triangle, each tetrahedron has four triangles around. So the picture here is that is one face, another face down here, another face down here, which they continue. So again, this is the edge, this is the vertex, this is the other vertex, and these are faces around it. It all sits around this thing here. So remember the picture I drew in three dimensions. This is a vertex. So the dual of a force simplex. It has one, two, three, there are two more edges. So two more, let me put them back here. One and two, don't see it because they're covered. So there's a face here, a face there, but there's also the cross faces. This face and this face, a lot of faces. And here I have four faces, one which continues with that, okay? One which continues with that, one which continues here, and one which continues here. Oops. I don't know if you see the picture. So each edge here has four faces, one, two, three, four. And the vertex, how many faces it has? Well, one, two, three, four. 5, 6, 8, 9, 10. Okay? 10 faces around, obviously. For each couple of edges sticking out of the face, for each couple of different edges, there are five edges. So how many couples of five things you can do? 10. Okay? So this is this is the analog of the picture that I drew a lot in three dimensions, just one dimension up. Let me do another picture. We'll work about this picture over and over again, so, especially in the dynamics. Let me draw another picture which I did not draw in one-dimensional law because it's a bit confusing, one-dimensional law. But here is not confusing. So it's easier to do it in four dimensions first, which is the following. Suppose I take this point and make a little ball around it. And since it's a little sphere around it, since I'm four-dimensional, it's going to be a three-sphere. It doesn't matter. It's a little sphere around it. Okay? This sphere is going to be cut by the edge coming out. And there are how many? There are one, two, three, four. Five. One, two, three, four, five. So on the sphere itself, I have five, one, two, the back one. One, two, this and this, and this. I have five intersections between the sphere and the edges. So all this picture here goes something which around a vertex. Okay? And then this sphere here will be cut by a face, which will connect this to, so we'll connect this with this. And another face, which will connect this with this, and another face, this one, which connect this with this, and of course you see the partner, between any two of these, there is a face. Okay? So again, this all represents a vertex, V. Now each point of this represents an edge, and each one of this line represents a face. The reason is a little bit confusing in four dimensions is that if you do that in four dimensions, you get a tetrahedron. But why is it confusing? Because we already had a tetrahedron there, which is the tetrahedron we started from. So in fact, there are two tetrahedra. There's one tetrahedron which is started from, and there's a sort of dual tetrahedron. And you know that if you have a tetrahedron, you stick a point in each face and you join, you get another tetrahedron, which is dual to it. So this is a dual tetrahedron. So in three dimensions, it's a little bit confusing. It's much more clear in the actual five things, because this is a four simplex. That's also four simplex, but it's a dual one. So this is a four simplex. In the dual picture is a vertex, and around the vertex, you can draw this thing here, which represents the vertex itself. But so this is a represent the four simplex. This is a tetrahedron in the boundary of four simplex. It's another tetrahedron that's a face between the two tetrahedra. Okay? So let's leave it there. I know. Let me give you a little bit more terminology. We're not going to need at all the dual of this and the dual of that. So we're only need this thing here, and that's again a two complex, exactly as in the previous case in three dimensions. So we only need two complexes. We only need vertices, faces, and edges. Okay. The only difference is not now that edges are four valent instead of three valent, and vertices are five valent instead of. Okay. So that's the object. So a two complex is still a set of vertices, edges, and faces glued to one another in this way. And this is still what we use for doing the triangulation. Now, we have to build all that just to put fields over it. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense to discretize the fields as before. So how do we do it? We do it in the following way. We have a connection, and so we construct a group element over it, and it's going to be the exactly like before along the edge. So for every edge, E, we have an element of SL to C. So we throw away the connection and we replace with all these SL to C group elements that sit on the edges. And we're going to use them, which morally is just, if you want to reconnect to the connection to start with, you think it's just a path integral, the parallel transport of the connection along this edge. Now we need another one. And the choice that works, in the sense that the choice that produces something useful after all sorts of attempts, is to use B. And to use B, and you'll see, in a sense, is exactly the analog of three dimensions, but the proper analog of three dimensions. I want something on faces. Remember that I had something on faces in 3D. It was on faces that I did something. So I want an operator a discrete field on faces. Okay. Now to get something on faces in one dimension less, the dual of a faces was a bone. So I just integrated the triad on a bone. But here in one dimension up, the dual of a face is a triangle. Okay. So let me integrate something on a triangle to get something on face. But something on a triangle to get something on a triangle. This is all has to be general covariant. I need the two form, because to integrate something on a triangle, only two form. And here is a two form. So let me define this for each face. let me define this object as the integral of the two form B on the triangle dual to the face, okay? Let me call it F, let me call it triangle F. For each face is a dual triangle and I integrate it. So this is how I think this quantities, these two quantities are related to the continuum thing. But now I just look at these two quantities here. And again, this is in the, an element of the group. This is an element of SL2C. It's an algebra because it's two indices, ij. But now let me go immediately to the boundaries because I'll use these things in the transition amplitude. But for the moment, today, I'm just interested in this in the boundary. So how do they reduce to the boundary? Well, the discretization just go down to the boundary. In the boundary, you have the boundary of these things. So you just have tetrahedra, triangles, and so on the boundary, I will still have a B associated to triangles. Which is just the integration of that on the triangles, which are on the boundaries. But on the boundary, the what's the boundary of this? The boundary of the triangulation is just a three-dimensional space triangulated with tetrahedra and so on and so forth. And the boundary of the two complexes is exactly as the boundary of the two complexes before, is a graph, okay? So the boundary of a two complex is a graph, which is obtained by what? By just cutting, looking at the boundary of this. So these are nodes, and these are links. Okay? And the set of all the nodes and the links on the boundary is a graph. It's a set of all the links and all the nodes, which bounds the two complex, which is exactly the dual of the triangulation. So on the boundary, B is still the integral of the triangle dual to a face, okay? But in the dual, I have just the boundary of the face, so I have a link. So this is a B associated to a link, to a link of the graph. Okay? Yeah. Now, on the boundary, this object here, remember, has two indices, ij. So I can break it in the k associated to that link and the l associated to that link. However, they're going to be proportional to one another. So forget the k and just look at the l. And on the boundary, I'll just look at the l. And I have one of these per each link. So what do I have in the boundary? I have a graph. On each link of the graph, I have one L. What's the geometry of this thing here? After all, it's all something defined in terms of the tetrad, right? Well, it's just written here. Okay. It's the integral on the triangle of one over gamma E with G. With a star. There's an epsilon. I'm looking only at the components. So let me look, write this in components. So I is one over gamma, the integral on the triangle. So the boundary of triangulated is a triangle of epsilon, that's what remains of the epsilon, ijk, ej, wedge, ek. So let's see. Can we give a sense of that? Suppose I have a triangle in the xy direction. Let's just put coordinates on the, around this little triangle. Let's put coordinates such that the triangle is just in the a triangle in the xy. So there, and just choose internal coordinate such locally E AI is just delta AI. This is gravity. In a point, I can always choose locally Cartesian three-dimensional coordinates. Then here I'm integrating dx, dy, but this is diagonal, so I only have the xy components. So lx is equal ly is equal 0. And the only thing that remains is lz. Lz is 1/2 the integral of dx, dy. Okay? Sorry. 1 over gamma, the integral of dx, dy, which is the area. The area of the triangle. So where am I? I have a graph, gamma, which is dual to a triangulation, and to each link, I have a vector, which is what? Which is, each node is a triangle, and the vector is nothing else than a vector which is normal to the triangle, and its length, so the vector sort of sticks normal to the triangle, and its length is 1 over gamma, the area of the triangle. Okay? That's half of the variables. The other half of the variables, it's this object here. But I'm on the boundary, so I just want to restrict my connection to BSU2, so on the boundary, I just consider U for each link as an element of SU2. So remember, face and links are dual to one another on the boundary. So on the boundary, what I have in the discrete theory. So discrete theory on the boundary. I have a graph, gamma, with links and nodes, and I have a SU2 element for each link, and I have a algebra element also for each link. Okay? Oh, that's exactly the structure we had before. That's exactly what we had before. So one could say, well, let's do the Hamiltonian analysis. In fact, the Hamiltonian analysis, obviously omega is going to be inside F, so it's going to be d omega there. So B is going to be just whatever is in front of d0 omega. So B is going to be the conjugate momentum of the connection. So this B should be the conjugate operator to that. So this L should be the conjugate operator. This should be the conjugate operator to that. So that could be the conjugate operator to that. So L. So we can go through all this story. Let's forget all this story. Let's just go straight to what we had already. So let's write an Hilbert space. Now I go to the quantization. I have an Hilbert space, which depends on that gamma, is a quantization of that particular discrete theory, which is going to be what? That's the same as before. L2 of SU2 to the number of links. But in fact, I want to have this gauge invariant as a node, exactly as before, divided SU2 to the number of nodes, where the action of this on this is given by the graph, exactly that happened in three dimensions, exactly the same, where these L, F, now are going to be operators here, going to be the same as before, left invariant vector fields acting on the states which are inside here, which are psi of UL, one group element, one SE2 group element per each link. And what's their interpretation? Well, they're going to be normal somehow to these triangles, and in particular, such that the length, let me call link here. To each face is dual to a link, so let me call link this. So the this is one of the gamma, the area. Wait, the units don't match here. This is a length square, and this is dimensionless. I've just SU2 vector fields, of course, but I'm in dimensionless units. So let me go back and find where my units are. Here they are. 8 pi g equal 1 h bar. So I have to put back h pi g and h bar to get the length square. So the area is going to be gamma 8 pi g h bar, the norm of this. Okay? How can I get an 8 pi g h bar? Well, of course, because the conjugate momentum of F is not B. Because in front there, there was 1 over 8 pi g. So the conjugate momentum of F is B divided h pi g. So when you do the Poisson bracket between B and omega, conjugate momentum of omega is F. So the Poisson bracket is going to have an 8 pi g there. And when you go to the quantum theory, they're going to be the commutator is going to be h pi g h bar, right? So your operators should have the not just dimensionless commutators, but h pi g h bar commutators. That's why you want your physical operators corresponding to the area being this multiplied by h pi g h bar. It matches. It's correct. And the gamma, which I show you where the gamma comes from. Okay? But now we know, you know the story, because we have run the story already. This is the area now is an operator. And what it is? It's just the Casimir, the square root of the Casimir. And we know the eigenvalues of that. The eigenvalues of the area operator are going to be h pi g h bar gamma square root of j j plus 1. Which is what you saw already in the first lecture, where it was sort of magically take the trade room, guess commutation relation, make a little algebra, and that's come out. Here it comes out. It comes out with an extra gamma here, h pi g, precise. And this is a relatively solid consequence of quantizing GR in this way. Now, of course, you have the tetrad, so in terms of tetrad, you can write other geometrical properties of that. So in a sense, this Hilbert space with its own operator should have the geometry. Now, there is a key difference before you jump too fast to conclusions with respect, and I want to say that before concluding, with respect to two dimensions. There, the set of operators here were a complete set in the sense of Dirac. You remember this, right? We proved it. But one part of the proof was that this H gamma, using the Peter Weyl theorem, if you remember the proof, could be written as a sum over JL of the product on all the nodes of the invariant part under SU2 of, if you remember, the Hilbert spaces of that was J3. J1, J2, J3, where of the Hilbert spaces in the Peter-Weyl decomposition associated to the face around, associated to the edges, to the links around the node, okay? And this is one dimensional. Right, I proved that. So therefore, it's just a sum over this quantum number zero one-dimensional things. So therefore, this was a basis. That's how we proved it. What is different here? It's different that around each node, there aren't three links, there are four links now. So if we repeat the same thing, here we have four Hilbert spaces. And now it's not true anymore that in the tensor product of four SU2 representations, the invariant part is one-dimensional. This thing here is what we already defined in the first class is J1, J4. That's how we call the invariant part of product of four SU2 representations, the intertwiner space. And it has a dimension, which is not one. It's a finite dimensional space. So if we want a basis, we better find an operator which is well-defined there, so it's gauge invariant in each node, and use a quantum number of this other operator to get a complete basis. Right? Are you following? And one good operator is the operator from which all this started, is volume. So if I write the volume of a tetrahedron, it's going to be written in terms of this L, this generators of SU2, and it's going to be well-defined on each node. It's going to be invariant because the volume is something that doesn't depend on the, how I rotate this thing. So I will have a volume quantum number for each node, and this will give me a basis in this Hilbert space here. So I wanted to arrive at this point, even if I rushed a little bit in the last part, because I wanted to have the Hilbert space operator, the basis of the geometrical interpretation, sort of written down. As I told you, Monday, Tuesday, I'm not going to be here. Are you doing it Monday? I didn't have your okay. Yes. Can I say that? So Eugenio is going to lecture Monday and Tuesday, and is going to explain that much better, I hope, and I am sure, because he does understand that much better than me. And he has worked enormously on this silver space and this geometric interpretation. So if I understand correctly, Monday you will talk about this Hilbert space, these operators, and the geometry. So this is a three-dimensional quantum geometry. Okay, so it will give you much more physics and geometry understanding of that. Again, these are the quanta of gravitational field. These are the quanta of space, like the photons are the quanta of the electromagnetic field. But there's a huge difference. The photons live in space, you have a metric, and the photons run around, a little quanta with their indeterminacy, uncertainty, or whatever, and there. While these quanta here don't live in space, they build up space themselves. There's a bunch of quanta that you put together, and space is made by this quanta. Exactly like in the classical theory, the gravitational field is not something that lives in space, it is space itself. So the physical picture, which I gave you in the lecture on the history, is not a physical picture in which you have something which is space and fields over it, but just fields, just quantum fields over quantum fields. And this quantum field sort of has the structural build-up, its quanta build-up space, and this is a Hilbert space that's operator that's sufficient for generating in the semi-classical limit a space. Once the geometry is clear, the three-dimensional geometry is clear, the problem will be to write transition amplitude. And that will be the next step, and then we'll have a tentative quantum theory of gravity. Sorry for going a few minutes over time. Questions?
Like, it seems as if you kind of have to discretize first, then quantize the discrete theory. But is there a way of doing it without initially discretizing?
Yes. In fact, the first time this was done, there was no idea of discretization whatsoever. So it was done with continuous field and a continuous operator corresponding to this and that. And in a sense, it's more clear because it doesn't bring this discretization in. On the other hand, it's far more complicated to do the dynamics. I'm not even sure if one can do a workable dynamic of that. One can write a dynamics much less workable. And especially, it brings a confusion. That's why I wanted to. It delivers a confusion. The confusion is the following. There are two separate things which are discrete here, which should not be confused one with another. One thing which is discrete is that you have one quantum space, another quantum space. Another thing which is discrete is that in each one of these nodes, the volume is discrete, the area is discrete. And the two should not be confused. Okay? And it's the field itself has gone through this confusion for a long time. And how do you disentangle them? Well, a posteriori is pretty easy. If you have a scalar field in a box, quantum, there are two sorts of discreteness. You can go to the modes. So you can replace the field with a discrete sum of things. Okay, but then, because of quantum theory, each mode, the energy is quantized. So a photon, it's one quantum, and the discreteness is nothing to do with the mode expansion. It has to do with the fact that each mode is quantized. That's the H-bar discreteness. Okay, here, the quantum discreteness has nothing to do with the triangulation. As long as I have a continuous triangulation, this is a continuous field. There's no H-bar here. Okay, the quantum discreteness is the fact that these geometrical objects have sizes which are quantized. That's where H-bar comes in. So this way of presenting thing has a disadvantage of sort of bringing this discretization to start with, but has the advantage that conceptually, I think, separate these two things. You can think of the triangulation like a mode expansion. In fact, if you have a compact space, think about cosmology, you can think that your fields live on a three-sphere, and you expand it in modes, and then the more fine is your triangulation, the more modes you capture, okay? So that's the discreteness. It's a truncation of the theory in which you forget some degrees of freedom, you take the degrees of freedom in one by one by refining triangulation. So that's classical, nothing to do with that. Then the quantum theory says that these individual modes are quantized and there is some discreteness there. The difference between gravity and everything else, which means when you and when you have a metric, is that usually if you have a mode expansion in the box, the mode expansion is something that goes smaller and smaller in scale. In gravity, the mode expansion doesn't know anything about scale, because if you have the universe as a three sphere and you do an expansion in spherical harmonics, it's just each mode can be larger. So the way it's realized is different because of different variants. But the triangulation itself, it's could be thought as a mode expansion. Other questions? Good. So have a nice weekend. Yes, it's Friday. And enjoy Eugenio. If you have tough questions, he's much better than me. He can answer the questions. He knows things deeply. And I'll see you Wednesday morning.